Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Scientists around the world are scrambling to destroy laboratory test kits that contain a deadly flu virus, which, if released, could cause a pandemic. Dr. Klaus Stora of the World Health Organization spoke with reporters in Geneva.
This virus is fully transmissible from humans to humans, and everybody born after 1968 would have no immunity.
Now, the WHO also says no one has been infected by the virus, and many lab officials, including those in Massachusetts and Arizona, for instance, say they've already destroyed the flu samples they received. The question is, how did this happen? Joining us on the line is Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease expert at the Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville. He joins us, though, on the line from the CDC in Atlanta. Dr. Schaffner, first of all, what are these test kits?
Well, laboratories have to remain up to par. They have to be able to do their work accurately. So organizations send out test kits of unknowns to laboratories, and laboratories have to identify the bugs that have been sent out, and they have to measure up to a very high standard. This is a quality assurance activity, and one wants laboratories to do very well. This, however, was a goof-up.
It certainly was, and we understand that the kits were put together by the Meridian Bioscience Company of Cincinnati. They were paid to prepare them by the College of American Pathologists, which, as you said, helps labs do some quality control and test their proficiency. Tell us about the strain that they mistakenly got. It's a 1957 strain. Why is it so deadly?
Well, back in 1957, we had something called the Asian flu, which was at that time a very new strain, and it swept around the world in a pandemic. I remember getting influenza at that time myself. And so this is a virus that, although it's been taken out of the archives, if you will, people are worried about, because folks since about the 1960s who were born since then have not seen this virus before, so they would be susceptible.
And how would this deadly virus end up in a test kit?
Ah, that's one of the great mysteries. That hasn't been revealed yet. We need to know exactly what happened. Every laboratory has safety procedures. However, human error occurs. In the last couple of years, SARS viruses escaped from laboratories in Southeast Asia, laboratories that were otherwise qualified. So these problems occur. Laboratories need to review their routine safety procedures and re-educate their personnel.
In fact, the Washington Post is reporting that this deadly strain might have been mislabeled at the Ohio Test Kit Manufacturing Company as benign and sent out in the kits. This is especially puzzling in a post-9/11 world, where wouldn't the concern be that something like a deadly flu virus would get in the wrong hands?
Wouldn't you think so? It just goes to show that no matter how careful you are, every once in a while there will be an error. Fortunately, this one was discovered very, very quickly by one of the laboratories that was using the test kit. They tested the virus, discovered what it was, probably redid their work, and then said, this can't be, and immediately called the World Health Organization.
Right. Now, these vials were sent to labs not just in the United States, but Belgium, Bermuda, Canada, Chile, Brazil, Hong Kong, Israel, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, South Korea. Are you confident that experts are going to be able to destroy them properly around the world?
Oh, yes. I'm really very confident of that. I believe that's underway as we speak. And they know how to destroy viruses. They do that every day in their laboratories.
Right. And how many of these deadly viruses are in how many labs across the country?
That's a very good question. We don't know the exact answer. Recall that we have clinical laboratories, commercial laboratories, government laboratories, and laboratories in academic medical centers. And many of them contain bacteria and viruses of varying degrees of seriousness for quite legitimate purposes. There's no single roster of every laboratory that contains every bug. I think we need to know more about that.
Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville. He's speaking to us today from the CDC's, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. Doctor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Israel is reportedly urging the White House to increase pressure on Iran to give up its nuclear program. The Israelis claim to have intelligence showing that Iran is much closer to building a nuclear weapon than American officials believe. The New York Times reports that the subtext of the exchange on Iran between Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and President George Bush earlier this week at the president's Texas ranch is a concern that Israel might act preemptively in Iran. And there's also another area where the two leaders disagreed at their Monday meeting, Prime Minister Sharon holding fast to an Israeli plan to add 3,500 housing units to a settlement just east of Jerusalem, President Bush saying the roadmap clearly says no expansion of settlements. Well, Paul Sham is an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, a visiting scholar at George Washington University, and for many years he was a resident of Jerusalem. We thought he'd shed some light on the significance of that settlement on the outskirts of the city. Welcome.
Good to be here.
And tell us, what happened at Crawford Ranch this week? How much was for show? How much was for real? What's your interpretation of what we heard from both leaders?
I don't think you could really say it was for show, but the fact is that both sides recognize that the settlement expansion that's been discussed for Male Adumim to the east of Jerusalem is in the future, and the important thing is the Gaza withdrawal. And neither side has any interest in undercutting the other. Ariel Sharon needs Bush in order to get, have credibility in Israel with the right that strongly disagrees with him. And President Bush needs Sharon in order to show that he's strongly on Israel's side. So basically, they agree to disagree, and basically they're saying after the disengagement, we will talk about expansion.
Well, this is what tends to happen in Middle East talks. There's always one thing that people put aside for the moment. But let's talk about that one thing that came out of this week, Male Adumim. Tell us about that settlement. Where is it? What would expansion mean? Describe it for us.
Well, Male Adumim is the largest settlement in the West Bank. It's due east of Jerusalem. You pass it, if you're going down to the Dead Sea, it's about 10 minutes or so or less from Jerusalem. It is a large community, and most people who live there really don't think of it as a settlement. Obviously, Palestinians do, but you are closer to many things in Jerusalem than for people who actually live within the city.
And it's large.
It's, I believe at this point it has about 30,000 people. So it's not an outpost with a few trailers. It's a real city, and it's been there for at least 20 years.
And the proposal from Prime Minister Sharon to add, I think, 3,000 units, what would that do?
The important thing is not so much the expansion, in my view, it's the idea of contiguity. And both Israelis and Palestinians are very concerned about this. The Palestinians are extremely worried that a future Palestinian state will not be contiguous.
And let's further explain that word, because Prime Minister Sharon used it. He said that the Israelis want contiguity between this settlement and Jerusalem, so that would building these units attach the two?
The idea is to make it basically one area from Jerusalem to Male Adumim. So basically there would be contiguity, and that would cut off the West Bank from East Jerusalem. Now, of course, it's possible to arrange it in other ways. It's possible to have tunnels. It's possible to have bridges, overpasses, things like that. But this would be a major step towards enclosing Jerusalem. And, of course, Prime Minister Sharon and many Israelis feel that they do not want to have East Jerusalem as part of a Palestinian state, that Jerusalem should be Jewish or Israeli.
And we're going to talk in a moment about some urban planners who are trying to envision a future Jerusalem. You've lived there. Could you first help us describe the city and how many other settlements are around it, and what is the feel of the area?
Well, Jerusalem is the largest city in Israel, apart from the suburbs around Tel Aviv. It has an urban feel, and the settlements are, for the most part, not really visible, except at the place I worked at Hebrew University. You could see out in the desert, and some of them were there. It is a divided city. It is one in which you are very aware in most points in which you are crossing over where the wall was between 1949 and 1967, that at that time blocked off the Israeli side from what the Arab or what was then Jordanian side. There are some smaller settlements that within Palestinian neighborhoods, in historic Palestinian neighborhoods, that some right-wing, usually religious forces have deliberately built in the middle of Palestinian areas, but the vast majority of Israel, of East Jerusalem's 200,000 Israelis, live in separate areas that are not within Palestinian areas.
Two questions for you, Paul Sham. Your sense of the city, first of all, even if these units at Mala Adumim are built 3 years down the road, what impact would that have? And even going beyond that, what is your sense that these communities can ever live together in this area?
I think it's possible to live together because it has been in the past, and I think it can be in the future, that Israelis and Palestinians can interact on a personal level and on a communal level. Ultimately, they will have to. Nobody, even the most extreme, except perhaps the most extreme Israelis, are talking about trying to get rid of the 200,000 Palestinians who live within Jerusalem. So there has to be coexistence. And I think that it is possible to have a city in which there is a shared sovereignty or a divided sovereignty as long as you don't have a wall down the middle. But of course, that means a recognition of Palestinian claims to Jerusalem on the part of Israelis and Israeli claims to Jerusalem on the part of Palestinians. And at this point, that's not there.
In these moments here, we're trying to envision a future in the area. And I'm still trying to picture something you mentioned. You mentioned that if this settlement extends to Jerusalem, then the Palestinians will have to find another way to get into Jerusalem. You mentioned tunnels. Do you mean, like, for instance, Long Islanders have to take the Midtown Tunnel under the Bronx to get into Manhattan?
It could be something like that. It could be an overpass, but it also could be something, it could be a surface road in which Palestinians coming from the Palestinian Authority go into Jerusalem, but this really depends on what the relationship between the two sides are. At this point, as opposed to 4 years ago, the watchword for Israelis is separation. Israelis are afraid for their security and are not interested in allowing Palestinians into Israeli areas. This was not the case a few years ago.
Paul Sham is an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Well, when we return, how urban planners at MIT are working with Israeli and Palestinian historians, architects from around the world, and a former deputy mayor of Jerusalem to imagine how that city might look in the year 2050. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've just been talking about Jerusalem today, in 2005. But what might that city look like 45 years from now? That was the question posed to Israeli and Palestinian and international urban planners, architects, historians, and artists at a weekend conference at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was organized by Diane Davis, a professor of urban studies and planning at MIT, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you.
And tell us, first of all, what was the idea behind this?
Well, a couple years ago, we had a visit by two graduates of MIT, a Palestinian and Israeli peace activist. It was right after the Second Intifada. They were very depressed and worried about the future of their city. They were friends, but were never able to see each other because of restrictions on movement and mobility. And they came to the United States and to MIT to look for some help in thinking about what to do next, how to get out of the difficult situation.
Yeah, and what's the basic premise behind it?
The basic premise, what we're trying to do is we thought it would be liberating and helpful to allow both sets of parties to imagine a better future, to be able to speak and dream in an uncensored way, and then work backwards from the ideal future to the real present. And that's a strategy that we are experimenting with, because all the tried and true ways of negotiating between parties just hasn't brought the progress that I think most people want.
Borrowing from sports psychology.
Maybe.
Envisioning the goal and then...
Exactly. And then once you think about where you want to be, then you have a different way of acting in the present.
And different thinkers, including a former mayor of Jerusalem.
Deputy mayor.
What were his thoughts?
Meron Benveniste, a very dynamic intellectual as well as activist and politician, he basically made the provocative claim that Jerusalem was dead as a city. And he wasn't really meaning Jerusalem, the entire greater Jerusalem area, but the idea, the mythology of Jerusalem is in essence not helpful anymore.
Is that a pessimistic view or a realistic view?
I mean, a realist. He's definitely a realist. And it's interesting that we asked him to, he's a historian as well, so the way a historian thinks about the present and the future is in a way different than other people. So he was trying to make the point that what Jerusalem was historically is no longer, and in a variety of ways. But I think that the spatial is a very important one, with the changing progress on the settlements and the spatial changes that have happened in the last couple of years and even recently.
I know you've thrown out questions to panelists who have discussed this topic. One of them was, if you were to construct a mutually inclusive project for the city that would accommodate all residents, what were some of the answers to that question?
Well, I think one of the most exciting answers to the question was by an Israeli political theorist. He was actually trained as a philosopher, who's a Jewish Iraqi whose family grew up in Iraq, and he actually interviewed his mother to get some ideas about his paper and his presentation. And he was making some recommendations about how to restructure neighborhood life in a way that allowed more integration, so to speak, on the level of the neighborhood between the different Palestinian and Israeli groups. He argued that would allow for more interaction among kids and families. You might get more intermarriage.
Was this his mother's idea?
Well, he drew on his mother's understanding of how Muslim and Jewish families live together in Iraq, and how gave great examples of how they would raise each other's kids and borrow each other's wedding dresses, and things that would be almost unimaginable in Jerusalem, especially now with the kind of destruction of mobility and the isolation of Palestinians and Israelis, the clear divisions between East and West Jerusalem that were never even there in the history of the city itself.
Yeah. Other ideas that people from different principles have come up with?
Well, if there was any disappointment I had about the conference, I wish there had been more ideas. And one of the things that became clear to us, the organizers as well as the participants, is that it's really hard to abstract yourself from the daily life that you're living in and think creatively about the future. And there was a lot of tension in that project of going from the grounded daily reality, terrible political reality, to imagining the future. People, in a sense, were reluctant because it felt naive or overly utopian mm-hmm. to think about the future. But to share one more, there was a Palestinian archaeologist that knows a lot about the history of East Jerusalem. He said, let's work on renovating the historic holy city, all the Islamic monuments, the Jewish, Christian monuments. And then we put together multicultural teams to manage and present and give tours of this area. The idea being that it would be a collective history, although I should say that Meron Benveniste then responded with, Jerusalem is dead. If we keep on tying our idea of Jerusalem to this old historic city, we don't look at the growth in space and the kind of inequalities and the poverty and the changing transformation of agricultural to urban land that really create what Jerusalem is.
Mm. But in the final analysis...
Yeah.
When you brought your many visionaries together on your panels, could the group agree on whether a future Jerusalem, a Jerusalem in 2050, would be a city still divided by community, or one in which it was completely transparent?
Well, actually, I think that was one of the things that struck me most about the group. We didn't expect everybody to have the same vision, but I was unprepared for there was not agreement even among our Israeli participants about whether Jerusalem of 2050 should be open or divided. And these were people that all cared deeply about conflict now and trying to eliminate it. The Palestinian participants seemed pretty much agreed on the idea of an open Jerusalem.
Professor Davis, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Diane Davis is a professor of urban planning at MIT here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Also at last weekend's Jerusalem 2050 conference, Professor Davis launched an international competition inviting ideas from around the world. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the chill between China and Japan. China says Japanese textbooks fail to paint an accurate account of Japan's occupation of China during the Second World War, and that's not China's only complaint. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats on Capitol Hill made fresh accusations today against the embattled House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. At a press conference this morning, House and Senate Minority Leaders Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid sought to link ethics charges against DeLay to what they call Republican abuses of power. DeLay is expected to respond to those charges when he speaks with reporters this afternoon. The majority leader has been accused of ethical lapses, including accepting trips paid for by lobbyists and foreign entities, accusations he denies. But the question is this behavior standard operating procedure, and is DeLay being singled out? For this, we turn to Bill Allison, the managing editor at the Center for Public Integrity, an ethics and lobbying watchdog group based in Washington, D.C. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Bill, House Majority Leader DeLay is seen as being very close to a number of lobbyists. It's pretty well documented. Tell us about these relationships, or at least the ones in question that concern you.
Well, you know, I think that in many ways, the scandals with DeLay are as much a scandal of the Washington lobbying establishment as it is with DeLay himself. The two key figures in this are Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon, both of whom have close ties to DeLay, and both of whom are Washington lobbyists. And you know, to give an idea of what the kinds of things that Jack Abramoff was up to, I mean, he's been accused by John McCain and others who are investigating his activities from the Senate of doing things like working behind the scenes to cancel an Indian tribe's casino license, then going to that tribe and saying, we can help you out, and charging fees of, you know, in excess of $30 million, and then turning around and going back to the same people they were running interference with and saying, okay, now you can go ahead and approve them for tribal status so they can get their casino license. I mean, these are the kinds of things that these guys were doing.
Playing the game from both ends.
Exactly. And again, the lobbying scandal is really kind of the centerpiece of this, and it's involved DeLay in the sense that Jack Abramoff is somebody who, you know, plays all the tricks that lobbyists normally do, but, you know, has gone a bit further. There's a nonprofit that took DeLay on three very expensive trips shortly after Abramoff made contributions to them, and of course what it looks like is that the nonprofit is being used to launder money from a lobbyist to take a member of Congress. I should say that DeLay is not the only one to go on these trips, although he does have the closest association with Abramoff. And, you know, I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, if you're an outsider looking at Washington, you can't help thinking, you know, what are these guys doing? How are these guys making millions of dollars doing this? But it is a practice which is, believe it or not, legal under our campaign finance system.
So then it's a problem with the rules as opposed to the action. I mean, if it's allowed and the congressmen do it, it's hard to quarrel with that on a legal basis, but you can say it looks bad.
Generally speaking, yes, it's really the appearance. And you can't point to that as something that is you know, something that's not done by other members of Congress and by, you know, and even presidential candidates.
Aside from Mr. DeLay himself, big picture, I assume that you would say that the problems Tom DeLay faces are really just one of the problems that faces the whole relationship between Congress and lobbyists.
Well, you know, I think we should be clear. I mean, I think that Tom DeLay is a poster child for everything that's wrong. I mean, you know, he certainly has taken things to greater extremes, but to some extent, yes. I mean, it is true that, you know, all members of Congress take trips funded by third parties, you know, these junkets where they go to, and they always seem to go to places like New Orleans and Las Vegas. They never go to Wichita, Kansas, or Des Moines, or Dubuque. You have lobbyists who are raining favors down on members of Congress. So that's one problem, which is every member of Congress is susceptible to that. A second thing is that you have the relationship between lobbyists and members of Congress is, I think it's, you know, an ongoing scandal. There, over the last, or since 1998, $13 billion has been spent on lobbying or disclosed being spent on lobbying the federal government in Washington. And these are special interests. You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, companies like Altria, which owns, you know, Philip Morris, the tobacco firm, trial lawyers, you know, the American Medical Association, the AARP, all of these interests have spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars lobbying Congress and going after members of Congress and trying to influence the decisions that they make for their narrow special interests that they represent. And, you know, they do it by, you know, they help members of Congress with fundraising. They sometimes they're consultants to campaigns or to 527s. I mean, there's a real incestuous political culture here in Washington between electioneering on the one hand and lobbying on the other. And all of these lobbyists, or a lot of these lobbyists, work as consultants to campaigns, then turn around and say, you know what, here's a favor that we need from you. And a lot more often than not, they're granted it.
Is there a proper role for lobbyists in Washington? I mean, if you approach it from the point of view of the lobbyist, who might say congressman and a congressman's staff can't possibly know every position on every issue, and it's my job to inform a congressman or a congresswoman about my group's take on a particular issue because the congressman needs all these points of view.
A lot of lobbyists say that, that what they do is they provide members of Congress with information they need to make decisions. We do have a tremendously large budget and huge congressional staffs to look at these issues, so I don't think that's fair. Now, a lot of times in state legislators or state legislatures, state lawmakers don't have the kind of budgets that members of Congress do, and I think lobbyists can more credibly make that argument in the states, but that's just one component of what lobbyists do, and another I would argue the larger component of what they do is to try to influence members of Congress into voting their way. And one of the ways that this is done is, you know, there have been a while back the energy bill that in 2002, I think it was going through the House and the Senate. It was a Microsoft Word document. A reporter got hold of the one that was making its way around Congress, and he looked at on Microsoft Word. You can open up the document to see who has previously edited the document, and he could see passages inserted by Southern Company's lobbyists, passages inserted by other lobbyists. You know, what you have is lobbyists writing legislation. That's more than just, you know, informing a member of Congress about an arcane copyright issue, for example. And again, part of that informing process, if I'm representing, say, you know, ExxonMobil, and I'm talking to my member of Congress and I'm telling him about some environmental issue, you can bet that I'm going to slant it to the betterment of my client's interests, and I'm not going to mention anything about, you know, pesky glaciers melting or global warming or anything else that might give the congressman pause and might make him think, well, maybe I should take a closer look at this issue.
Bill Allison, thanks.
Thank you.
Bill Allison is the managing editor at the Center for Public Integrity. There's more ahead here and now. We'll be right back. The Recording Industry Association of America is launching its latest legal salvo today in what it sees as a battle against free file swapping. The association, which represents the recording industry's largest labels, is filing suit against some 400 college students from 140 schools across the nation. According to the recording industry, the students are taking advantage of a private research network called Internet 2 to download and distribute copyrighted movies and songs. For a look at the technology and philosophy of Internet 2, we turn this morning to Wayne Chang, who's developed a related online program called i2Hub that the recording industry says is part of the downloading problem. Wayne is in his sophomore year at UMass Amherst, and he's taken leave to work full-time at i2Hub. Wayne Chang, first let me get you to explain what i2Hub is and what its relationship with Internet 2 is, but do it, if you would, in a non-technical way.
Okay, I'll try. This piece of software allows students and faculty on campuses worldwide to be able to connect to each other, collaborate, share ideas, exam reviews for students, to transfer files or anything at super fast speeds. And it utilizes a private network. In the U.S. it's called Internet 2, and Canada and elsewhere they have different names for it.
And presumably some of those files that students are transferring are research that they've done or communications with professors that they're interested in sharing and that other students are interested in seeing.
Right.
But some of the files might also be music and films, things that the Recording Industry Association of America and the entertainment industry in general is concerned about.
Sure, but we're mostly like AOL or any online chat place. We don't facilitate or anything more so than any other company.
So do you feel that Internet 2 is being unfairly targeted in these new lawsuits?
Yeah, we don't see any reason to target us specifically other than the fact that we're a new technology in a new medium, which is Internet 2. We look at ourselves in a way that we're sort of like AOL's Instant Messenger, and we're like IRC, which is an online chat place. And our technologies are very similar in that everybody connects to it. But we're not like Napster or anywhere in the sense that we don't have a centralized index of files. We're really P2P.
In other words, there's no list of music and movies that people can go to download.
Right.
Can you see the point of the entertainment industry in which it argues that, it's losing money because files are being shared and music and movies are being viewed by people who haven't paid anything for them?
Oh, yeah. I2Hub don't support or condone any activities that breach the rights of copyright owners. But historically, the entertainment industry has sued every new technology that's come into place. When radio came out, that was the death of radio. That was the death of music. When VCRs came out, that was the death of TV and films and everything. But afterwards, after the litigation process, then the industry decides to adapt to it. And now DVDs and tapes, they make up more than 75% of the revenue coming in. And this is just the case where Internet 2 is the next frontier, and now they're deciding to turn their eye on it and trying to stop it.
So you think that the entertainment industry will eventually figure out a way to embrace it and make money off it?
Right.
Wayne Chang, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Wayne Chang is founder and developer of i2Hub. He's been named in a lawsuit filed by the Recording Industry Association of America, alleging that his online program contributes to illegal downloading of music and video. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. NBC is hoping that tapping into the latest pop culture and political phenomenon, religion, will bring a ratings resurrection. With the success of everything from The Da Vinci Code to Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, NBC is counting on its new miniseries to inspire viewers to tune in. It's called Revelations. It premieres tonight, complete with fire, brimstone, thunder, and lightning. And the plot? Oh, just the end of the world.
More than 2,000 years ago, the first Bible looked far ahead to the world at the end of time. A world of wars and rumors of wars, such as has not occurred since the beginning of creation. This is the world foretold as the end of days.
The series is inspired by the New Testament book of Revelations and follows the globe-trotting adventures of a skeptical Harvard astrophysicist and a renegade nun who's convinced that the signs are in place for the end of the world. Well, joining us to talk about the show is Noel Holston. He's chief television critic for Newsday, and he's been writing extensively about Revelations. Noel, welcome.
Hi, Robin. It's nice to be on.
And as we just said, one of the main characters, Sister Josepha, am I pronouncing that correctly?
They just call her Sister Jo for short. She has to look like sort of a cross between Julie Andrews and Audrey Hepburn, extremely cosmopolitan friendly in terms of looks and so forth.
And she's played by Natasha McElhone. And as I said, she's convinced that the signs are in place for the end of the world and is trying to stop it. Now, right there, I'm wondering if that's going to raise a problem for some viewers who are evangelical Christians.
Oh, I think it will. And I think that, not that I'm giving them that much credit for being great theologians, but Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, the guys behind the Left Behind series of books about the rapture and the second coming, have already really seriously dissed this movie. Because they say that, why would somebody, who's a Christian be trying to stop the things that the Bible predicts?
In fact, many Christians embrace the notion of this sort of end of world.
Look forward to it, absolutely.
What is the premise of the book of Revelations?
Oddly enough, I've been reading the book a lot lately since I started trying to review these, and I'm sorry, I'm going to get into trouble here, but it's like a fever dream of this apostle who, for some reason, decides that after all the messages of the four Gospels and Jesus being the Prince of Peace, but he's going to come back and just really slaughter people and take the good to heaven and let the rest rot.
Well, Noel, you are going to get in trouble.
Because
as Christians, there are many evangelical Christians who, as we said, embrace this notion. And so for Sister Jo to try to stop this, as you write, she's looking for some sort of cosmic loophole.
She says, there's a line of dialogue that says that she believes that the Bible left a blank for man to fill in, to basically reverse things, which is very convenient since if all they did was sort of sit down and pray during this time, there wouldn't be much of a movie or a miniseries.
Right. Here she is enlisting the help of Bill Pullman. He plays the part of the skeptical Harvard scientist. Let's listen.
Dr. Massey, I've been sent here by this. It's a map. Written with archaic symbols, drawn by a child. She's speaking the word of God. All the signs and symbols are currently in place for the end of days.
Oh, boy. And the child who's speaking in tongues is in a coma. Much has been made of the fact that this show is picking up on a lot of current news themes.
Well, I mean, it's not like the Terri Schiavo case wasn't in the news already. It's just become, obviously more prominent in the last few weeks, but there is a girl who has been struck by lightning and who's in a vegetative state, and the evil doctors want to harvest her organs because they say she's brain dead, and Sister Josepha and some other renegade Catholics are trying to steal the girl away and hide her so that the evil doctors can't get at her. There's also a second child, though. There's actually the apparent, second coming of Jesus, which is a sort of Gerber-quality baby that's found floating on a chunk of debris from a shipwreck in the Adriatic Sea by a bunch of Greek sailors. This is apparently going to be the Christ child that the professor and the nun are going to have to protect.
Well, Noel, what do you think's going on here? In a CNN Time magazine poll from 2002, 59% of the respondents said they believe that these apocalyptic events that we've been talking about, described in the Revelations, are going to come true. Do you think NBC has their finger on that pulse?
I think that the NBC is trying to exploit or serve this audience. I think it's iffy as to whether that audience is going to go for this, because it does not follow the same track that some of the other apocalyptic fiction does.
I think I read somewhere that the creators of the show said they thought it might be a really good time for this show because people seem to be nervous. What else do you think is going on in the, let's say, the political climate that might have spawned this show?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that the big Republican win and the reasons that have been given for it, the importance of the evangelical Christian base of the Republican Party, how getting those people out, you know, to vote turned the tide. You know, the networks, they go whichever way the wind blows, and they're equally happy to put on Fear Factor or Will and Grace or Revelations.
Well, Fred Schmidt, he's a religious scholar at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, has been waging an email campaign against the NBC show Revelations because he thinks that many fundamentalist Christians in particular are going to be offended because, as we said, the main characters are trying to ward off an Armageddon instead of embracing it. And it's really a series that didn't spare any symbolism, signs, sound effects. And there's also the requisite bad guy, a Satan worshiper. He's the one who killed the Harvard professor's daughter in a ritual sacrifice. Here's a sampling of some of his ranting.
Your God deserted you when I choked the life from your child. For I am come to ready his bed.
I do not blame.
I think virtually all the actors in here studied at the Vincent Price School of Gothic Horror. You know, everybody speaks in these incredibly hushed and kind of funereal tones and everything, like they're, you know, reading The Raven or Annabelle Lee by Poe or something. And the villain is just this classic schlock villain who's kind of like a, you know, this bloodless Nazi type. The whole thing is pseudo-religious schlock, and that's why people should be annoyed by it, not because it messes with Revelations. It's just because it's just so full of cliches and borrowings from past horror movies, sort of melded onto these religious themes.
Whatever happened to Touched by an Angel? Highway to Heaven.
Oh,
you know?
I think soft religion is kind of out right now. There's actually I read an article in which the head of programming at NBC talked about the fact that the soft approach, you know, the Touched by an Angels and Highway to Heaven and Joan of Arcadia, it just is not going to get any more. People want in your face religion. I guess that means, you know, religion crossed with a sort of Terminator theatrics.
It would seem like the show has another problem, which is it's got a built-in storyline problem. You know, if the end does come, well, then it's over.
That's a very big problem for it, but it's also got a huge problem in the fact it's up against the American Idol results show. We'll see, you know, whether there'll be idol worship or a gravitation to Revelation.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens, as I said, tomorrow. Noel Halston, chief television critic for Newsday. Noel, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. I enjoyed it.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Between us, and I'll kiss you. Drop your defenses and come into my arms. I'm all for believing, I'm all for believing. I'm all for believing if you can reveal the true colors within.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.